Welcome to the Evolution Eats podcast. My name is Noah.
And I'm Emily. And today we have a special guest, Emily Fregon. We actually went to high school together, and she has an economics degree, but has been working in the food space for a while now, first with Hungry Harvest and then in the social media food space. So could you tell us a little bit about, to start, just like your personal philosophy regarding food and how it became like a topic of focus for your career?
For sure. So first of all, thank you, Noah and Emily, so much for having me. I'm so excited to chat with you guys today. If I was to say my personal philosophy around food, it definitely centers on three main tenets. Eating well should not be expensive, time-consuming, or burdensome for anyone. So I've been fortunate enough to be really privileged in that I've always had access to really nourishing foods while growing up. With that, I've always kind of kept sustainability in mind. Meat is pretty taxing on the environment, so that's kind of why I have been shifting really into the plant-based space. I was actually raised vegetarian, so I really feel like our diets are the number one way that we as individuals can really impact the overall climate effort. However, I also think that it's really important to eat in a way that is feasible for your lifestyle. Your diet is obviously shaped by so many things: your culture, socioeconomics, education, free time, other responsibilities, etc. So, like I said, eating plant-based is a privilege, and I just want to recognize that. And my hope is that someday it will become much more widespread amongst many groups in our country. So like you said, Emily, I majored in economics with a global studies minor in sustainable systems.
Oh, cool.
Which was a really cool combo. Yeah, I really liked that. And that is because I think that the most influential change when it comes to sustainability will come from the food system, but also backed by corporate and government agencies. So I find that kind of working that sustainable thinking into pre-existing systems is just going to be probably the best way to evolve things and really have demonstrative change on the ground. So yeah,
I think we definitely agree with that overall philosophy. Yeah, your Instagram, what you were saying, like, you think it should be easy and accessible. You focus on like easy meals, like quick meals, right, on your...
Yep. So I have a personal blog that I work on as well. And my main focus there is really trying to keep as many like 15-minute meals as possible, but also free of really expensive or hard to source ingredients. So I try to keep the ingredients pretty minimal. And my hope is that it's pretty accessible for people and that it's not never going to seem, you know, too out there. And it'll actually be helpful when incorporating into your diet.
Yeah, that's great. I really like that emphasis on simple, easy, accessible. I think a lot of people want to eat better, but you don't have time or don't prioritize it, don't want to have to make it such a, you know, huge time sink.
Is there any crossover with like the overall minimalist movement in what you're doing with food? Is that sort of an inspiration, or are those people coming to you as well to see how to live a more minimalist life in the food world?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting perspective, because on the one hand, we've seen this enormous growth in processed foods that are more available now, which I don't think that there's anything wrong with processed foods in moderation, but we've seen there are so many brands coming out these days with like, you know, easy snacks, and it's really been a balance for me with figuring out, okay, there's a piece of my life that needs to be convenience because that's just how life goes. And then what parts of my diet and of my life can I really kind of take charge of and make more minimal and in the most seamless way?
Awesome. So what do you work for Hungry Harvest. Can you tell everybody what previously, I know you don't anymore, but just tell everyone like a little bit about what that company does and what you did there.
For sure. So Hungry Harvest is a recovered produce delivery service. This means they focus on taking food items, primarily fruits and vegetables, that were not viable enough for the grocery store shelves due to either size, shape, or cosmetic imperfections. So this is a whole wide variety of foods, and this movement is actually growing a lot, which is wonderful. There are a few other large companies in the space right now, as you guys know. Anyway, Hungry Harvest will pack these fruits and veggies into subscription-style boxes and deliver them right to customers' doorsteps. So a great way to focus on the convenience piece while also getting in the whole food element. I really loved working there. Hungry Harvest really cares about keeping things affordable for people, but also really nutrient-dense and easy. I was fortunate when I was there, I co-founded a food as medicine program. So this was operating within the subscription box model, but really focused more on grant-funded initiatives that would deliver boxes of fruits and vegetables to medically dependent members of the healthcare system. So really, really rewarding. I feel really fortunate for my time there, like I said. Yeah, and it's something that I'm really hoping will continue to grow in popularity.
The food is medicine kind of movement or
right
box.
And just yeah increasing or just, access to all different kinds of groups of people. Yeah.
Sorry, did you say I missed this? I think did you say it was the Harvest RX program was free for people in hospitals or discounted?
Yep. So our mission was always to make it free for people. So we would operate with nutrition grants.
Okay.
That was every now and then it would just work out better for the organization that we partnered with to have it at a discounted rate. But most of the time it was completely free for people, which was really cool.
That's super awesome. I mean, we really are interested in sort of the food waste angle here. So if you can sort of connect food waste and food in food security together, we're really interested in anything that does that. And so I think that's one of the things we like about those kind of models. And yeah, Imperfect Foods was founded out here, right?
That's right.
In San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And Misfit Markets is another one I've heard of. There's a whole bunch. But those are the other mm-hmm. two big ones I've heard of doing similar things to Hungry Harvest.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's like you said, there is so much food in our food system, so much that is grown right here in this country that goes to waste for so many different reasons. So I think it's great that more brands are emerging in the space and kind of doing similar work.
So after that, you started working more in like the social media space with food blogs. Is that so? How did you get into that? And do you enjoy that? You still do that, right?
I do, yes. So I really became interested in working with online food brands when I wanted to start my own blog. Okay. Obviously, starting a website, there are very low barriers to entry, yeah, which is true. Nice. You can kind of anyone who just wants to have a hobby can just pick it up. So I've always enjoyed cooking and baking. It was just a place for me to – just a creative outlet for me, honestly. But there is so much to learn when it comes to setting up a website, how that works, how to actually take good photos of food. It's a whole slew of skills to take on. So yeah. I started off with Emily Eats. I was just interning for her initially just to learn. I am now on her team as her operations officer, so that's been really fun. I've also worked with and still work with a few of these websites, but I've worked with Humisapien, who's a dietitian based out of Ohio, Choosing Chia, and then Minimalist Baker, who I'm sure you guys know.
Yeah, cool. That's so awesome.
It certainly seems that the way to get into most people's kitchens or homes these days is to get to them on social media, right? To find a way to speak to them in those microsecond long bursts of attention people have these days, right? So do you think that when you're talking about working for these various, I would say, new media enterprises, that's really where a lot of the conversations in food these days originate?
That is a great question, and I think social media is something that we could honestly spend an entire hour talking about because social marketing is evolving so quickly, and it's really nuanced. Mm-hmm. I personally do feel like we're in a bubble right now when it comes to social media, particularly social branding. Hmm. I think that it's such a new phenomenon. Brands really don't know how much it's worth for that kind of engagement. I think that overall, promoting brand interaction in a variety of ways is the most healthy way to really make sure your message permeates. So for me, when I'm working with brands, I try to focus beyond just the Instagram space. Mm-hmm. I think, like you alluded to, Noah, it can be, honestly, it has a reputation for being rather vapid and just kind of super, super fast, nothing really. It's hard to talk about really serious issues when you're just scrolling through an endless feed of posts. Mm-hmm. So I try to find other ways to connect with people. Some of my brands will organize in-person meetups, which I think is really cool just to kind of get people connected out of their phones back into the real world. Because at the end of the day, bringing something into your kitchen, making a meal for your family, is an inherently very personal thing. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that it can be easy to forget that when we're just kind of like bogged down in the social media space. But at the end of the day, you know, when you choose to make a recipe from someone, it's a personal and important choice. So that's why I do feel like there is some hope in that regard.
There certainly could be. I mean, I think that people are certainly spending time on recipes, but that's just one of many ways they're interacting with this media content. And it's, for better or worse, it's all online now. We figure out what that means. We have to say, okay, is this the kind of interaction you want to be having? And how do we get actual information out of this? And I think you're right. Having some interaction that's more than just that microsecond burst is huge. Doing anything in real life is how to get people to change their mind, to change where their attention is going. And when they are actually interacting with the food, it's usually for more than a few seconds, right? So,
yeah. I liked what you said about you organized in-person things, but maybe it's like you build sort of a brand through social media and then that's how you get people for in-person things. I mean, yeah, I don't know very much mm-hmm. about this, but
I guess. I mean, is this the world we have now? Right? Is this how young people are actually looking at food? God, maybe it is.
Well, also we need to remember too that there's a major piece of this that comes down to comparison, which can become dangerous, and extreme privilege. Mm-hmm. Sure. So especially when you come to the healthier food space, I mean, myself as a very privileged person, I need to check every single day because appropriation happens all the time. Extreme privilege that goes unchecked all the time. These are all just things we need to keep in mind when we're kind of growing and evolving as brands.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Wow. So how do you deal with that? What are the sort of concrete steps that you're taking to manage the message you're projecting?
For me, it's been really trying to diversify my feed as much as possible. This is something that I would recommend to anyone who's just looking to make more connections or even just grow any kind of brand, not just a food brand, mm-hmm. is to diversify the messages that you're bringing into your platform. So I try to really make sure that I'm following all different kinds of accounts. I'm really from all different kinds of cultural backgrounds. It's really important making sure I'm following people that don't just eat like me or look like me. Maybe I have my own personal food philosophy, but I think it is so valuable to bring in other perspectives, just to, you know, learn and better understand where other people are coming from. I think that it's really, really easy to just stick with your own lane and only follow people that think like you and look like you. So that's been one way. And just always keeping an open mind and always being willing to learn and expand your horizons.
I think that's great advice that I feel like I haven't heard enough of. Becomes these like bubbles where you only follow people that agree with you. I mean, it's just an expansion of real life where you tend to like associate with people that agree with you, right? Because you don't want to feel threatened, but it's just so much easier on social media than you form all these bubbles where you don't follow or you don't interact with anyone that has any different views than you do. And then that can create this sort of extreme culture, I think.
So true, yeah.
So what do you think about, I don't want to ask this in the wrong way, but just I think that there is definitely a lot of people are really trying to increase their social media following and maybe at the expense of sort of ethics, like doing so by like buying followers or other sorts of unethical, what I would consider like unethical means. Do you think that, I don't know, do you see that as a common thing? And where's your sort of personal line there?
In terms of just the ethics of growing your brand?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, for one, I think it's getting harder every day to build brand ineffectually. I've noticed that really growing brands at all on the social space is becoming more challenging with all the new restrictions. Honestly, since probably last couple of years, Instagram has really cracked down on any kind of bots that are buying followers.
Okay.
So for me, what's helpful for me personally is to take the shift off of social and use social as a space to maybe kind of get new ideas and keep up with what other people are doing. But that's why I think it's so important to actually have a concrete website. I really focus a lot on growing on Pinterest. Pinterest mm-hmm. is a huge space. Like, Pinterest is not a social media. It's a search engine. That's mm-hmm. what Emily Abear right. always says, Emily yeah. Eats. Yeah. It is a search engine. So if you can grow your brand in that space, that's going to be the way that you can be most helpful for people. I also feel like it really puts the focus on the content and less so on the person behind it, which can be helpful for sure.
Podcasting, right, is a whole other form of social media that we're getting into, and even Instagram. I mean, I think sometimes people do, like, they think personalizing it can be beneficial, can make it more relatable to people. So I don't know. I guess it depends on the type of brand. Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about this. Like, it depends on like the type of image you're going for.
What you see is the issue is whether you're treating it as the brand presence of a larger company or you're treating it as an actual platform to share organic information, right? So how you do each of those different things actually becomes a different activity, right? Depending on how big you are. Is that true?
Yeah. Do you have thoughts? Do you agree?
I would agree. I've seen other brands that really do very, very well sharing incredibly personal information. I think that makes sense because as humans, we are hardwired to want to learn those kind of like juicy details from mm-hmm. people.
Yeah.
I don't think for what I'm trying to achieve and what some of the brands that I work with are trying to achieve, it really just centers back to how am I able to help people with my recipes. That's what it comes back to. I don't find that I personally am like wise enough to be pushing my message onto people like through my personal life. I also don't think my personal life is that interesting. Gotcha. So I think that it's tricky, and it certainly works for some people. But again, yeah. It just kind of comes back to what kind of brand do you want to be? What kind of presence do you want to put out there?
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think the challenge there is to actually be a brand, and people who are starting out trying to just be themselves or share information have never thought about themselves or their ideas mm-hmm. as a brand in the first place, right? So how does one who really wants to even do that start to think of themselves in that way and think of what they're doing as a sort of a company?
So if I was to just a quick comment on that, that I think that I've actually been reading about when it comes to people that are just starting off trying to think of a name for a business they want to build. Mm-hmm. Well, what's helpful for me was not having my own name in the business. Right. That kind of really helps me just mentally separate what I'm trying to do. Obviously, for some people, that's really, really, that works really well for them. Me personally, I like having the brand that I'm building as being separate from me as a person. I think that that helps me produce more quality content and helps me stay really focused and aligned on my visions for that.
That's great feedback. And obviously, we've seen Emily Eats have plenty of success with her own name in the business. But the traditional wisdom, it's not impossible. Traditional wisdom simply says, if you're not already famous, it can be very hard to make your own name the brand name because nobody previously knows that name as having any other effect. Mm-hmm. So it's a harder hill to climb, but I very much agree.
So, Arl, have all of the brands you've worked for, is their focus, would you say, like healthy recipes, or do you do kind of different stuff?
For the most part, I've been pretty focused in the healthy recipe space. That is what I kind of just know the best and have been around the most. I have worked with a couple other brands that aren't so much focused on that, but most, if not all, are just trying to make it easier for people to empower themselves in the kitchen, plant-based, gluten-free, whatever. That's just what their overarching goal is, and that's kind of what my personal goal is too.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So you said you were a vegetarian. Are you still a vegetarian? You said you were raised vegetarian.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I am.
And so I know that you mentioned to me before that you got a plant-based nutrition certificate from Cornell. You know, I don't know, is there any reason that you pursued that? What did you think you learned from that? And I guess also what's your general, you already said that you like support plant-based eating, but maybe why?
Definitely. So I got the plant-based nutrition certificate from Cornell back when I was working with Hungry Harvest, just because I thought that it would kind of provide me a more nuanced lens through which to build that program. I am definitely not a dietitian, but it was a really great way for me to just have a very high level intro into the plant-based movement, kind of where it got started. Some of the key founders of the movement were teaching the courses through Cornell. So that was really cool that I could kind of learn from some of the top researchers there, learn about the history of the movement, see where they thought it could be going. I really prefer the term plant-based over something like vegan, because I feel like the word vegan brings with it so many negative connotations these days. It really focuses on what you're not enjoying. Whereas I like plant-based because it's really a phrase of abundance. It's focusing on all the wonderful things you can enjoy. And I never want people to feel like, oh, well, I need to have this label to define my life. I want things to really be as inclusive as possible. And that certificate was just a really neat way for me to have a lot more unique knowledge that I'm, you know, not getting because I'm not pursuing a typical nutrition degree.
Right. It's good you said you're not a nutritionist. I think, there's definitely this thing where, I mean, I have a master's degree in nutrition science, but even like I will say I'm not a dietitian. I'm not because there is like a very rigorous program that, you know, if you want to do like clinical nutrition and clinical dietetics, that it's good for people to know that people have that specific certificate, I think.
Maybe you both can speak to this, but what do you think is the overall percentage of people with professional experience of any kind who are giving food advice or content in the social media space and with any sort of brand presence? Do the majority of them have any actual, you know, education in this, or are the majority of them just really interested and living it as life? It's not necessarily an attack on them. I'm just curious.
No, that is such a great point. And that's, again, something where I think people really need to check themselves, because it's really, really easy I've seen it with the brands that I work, even some of the larger brands that I've worked on. If you're getting people coming back to you asking all these kinds of really in-depth nutrition questions, you need to be careful, because like I said, food, and Emily, as you know, nutrition is so incredibly nuanced when it comes to you're actually going to be certified, all the schooling you need to have, and I am not at all close to that. Mm-hmm. I just like to make recipes for people. Yeah. But it's tricky when people start to view these larger brands as more than what they are. So.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I can't give you a percentage. I do think that dietitians and experts in nutrition see it as a problem, that just being able to get all these little 2-month certificates in nutrition and then people call themselves a nutritionist.
Or a health
coach. The word, right. Or health coach because the word nutritionist is not like legally protected. So that's why there's this whole thing with dietitian and nutritionist, although there is like a movement from, not movement, but an opinion from sort of like master's and PhD level nutrition scientists that also is kind of like, oh, we don't want the dietetics credential to be the only thing that's legit because like we do have this different, I mean, maybe not a clinical expertise, but also like this strong expertise in nutrition. And
definitely.
Yeah. So it's a kind of interesting thing that I think about sometimes. So we're really focused on sustainability here. So what do you think, how would you define sustainability in general and then maybe in the context of food? And is it something that you think is directly related to plant-based or... Yeah, that's a lot of questions. But.
No, I get where you're going. So as I kind of alluded to at the beginning, the way that I eat has always been first and foremost since I've been, not like a small child.
Yeah.
Has been really shaped with how my diet affects the planet. So that's been kind of my number one focus when mm-hmm. it comes to, taking control of my diet. I think that sustainability inherently is just remembering that any of our actions do have an impact on the planet and that we have control over some of those actions. If we want to maintain our quality of life, it is imperative to, act in these ways. I think that we also need to remember environmental sustainability specifically focuses on, there are many other groups of beings on this planet that are already feeling the effects of things like climate change. So looking outside of ourselves is another crucial piece to kind of support overall humanity with our personal choices. But however, if we kind of want to take the other side of the coin there, sustainability is eating in a way that considers the planetary implications, but also something that is sustainable for you. So eating in a way that is something that you can maintain and that is realistic for your life. And that's why I think, unfortunately, so many people struggle with eating well because they think that they need to, go on 12,000 calorie diets or 1,200 calorie diets that take really extreme measures. Wow, not 12,000. Anyway, I'm sure you guys could speak to that as well, the extremities.
Yeah, I think that's something we talked about on Emily's episode, just like the extreme nature of diets and sort of the whole eating culture. And right on one extreme, you have obesity and the other extreme, you have eating disorders. And there's a whole bunch of stuff there when people feel like these restrictive diets are the way they're being taught to eat. It's not healthy.
I think what's interesting is that diets are one of the easiest ways to project a food lifestyle in media and in social media so that you do have this sort of core niche type focus where that's what can build an effective brand. That's what gets people's attention over and over again, whether it's a vegan athlete or some sort of paleo person that's super focused on eating meat all the time. Those sort of miniature groups, those hyper-focused niches, have developed quite a following recently. I think it's because that's what makes people really get their attention focused up. That's mm-hmm. what's sensible with the microsecond burst of Instagram attention or whatever it is on media. So the nuanced approach there doesn't really get talked about. It's how does the average person actually live a better life? It's more like this media entity, this brand, this personality is showing off this sort of miniature celebrity perspective, which is very entertaining and very interesting and very, in their own way, very focused. But it's not actually very recognizable or malleable. What's the word? It's not able to be precisely followed by the average person in a way that's really meaningful to them. Mm-hmm. They can't sort of copy these people as perfect examples of how to live a nice, balanced, healthy lifestyle.
Definitely not. There's so much flashiness
right
out there with, wow, this looks like this could,
change the
help
world.
Every aspect of my life. If I just eat like this, and I'll be perfect, which I hope that we'll continue to shift away from that.
Yeah.
It's definitely gotten better.
Yeah, you think? Yeah, but, I mean, I would argue that's just an inherent human thing. perfection. Mm-hmm. Like, we want a silver bullet to solve things, to solve problems.
Right.
It just never is, you know, that easy.
And there are solutions like that, but they might be too expensive, or they might be too rare, or they might not be perfect for everybody.
Well, then it's not a silver bullet.
Well, sure.
I mean...
Sure. So the right answer may in fact just be, you know, not sexy enough for social media. And that certainly happens. Mm-hmm. And we see this problem again and again every day with here's what's visible, here's what's flashy, here's what's getting the most likes and attention and shares and retweets. But is it always the best advice? Almost never. So we're trying to break through that slowly, and it's always a process. I think everyone who's in this space and knows the objective, I love how you talk about it's your number one focus, you're having these ideas in the back of your mind, but man, that's tough to see below the surface of what's really out there for the average person to see, right? I don't think those core messages are widely on the surface. They're buried below.
Definitely. At the end of the day, for me, if that's what it takes to get someone to make these recipes and like them, mm-hmm. then I kind of have to be okay with that. That
right.
is another tricky of part of this is when it comes to social media, if we're just talking purely on, you know, likes of a photo, mm-hmm. the photo that's going to get the most likes for me is the photo that is the most styled, the most perfectly lit, the most beautifully, mm-hmm. you know, aligned. Mm-hmm. People are not going to like a photo of just like that I snap of my dinner when I'm like eating, you know, potatoes and lentils. Like that's not exciting. Mm-hmm. But again, I mean, it's tricky to figure out like what is the right line there, how much mm-hmm. realism do we need on social media for it to still be approachable for people?
I guess that's sort of a better way of what I was trying to ask you earlier. I think
right, and don't take my critique as any sort of condemnation of what either we're doing or what you're doing or what related companies are doing. I think the issue is structurally the right thing isn't the thing that's going to get the most appeal. So how does any of us help to share the right information in the most interesting way? That's the battle we're always having, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
So we're hoping, you know, with this podcast that people, it's a little more nuanced, you know, but then again, you know, a lot of people don't want to listen to something for this long. So, you know.
and really in this space, this is the only space that I think people consider a modern media form where they're willing to dig into the weeds and actually have long conversations about these things and then listen. Mm-hmm. Other types of media, unless you have a really, really convincing video on YouTube or somewhere, it can be really hard to get people's attention and to keep it.
Yeah, but I feel like for like recipes, you know, and pictures of food, I mean, I feel like that can be done pretty well on other platforms.
But nuance is more challenging.
Well, yeah,
in those situations.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly. Mm-hmm. Certainly.
But what nuance do you need there?
The nuance of what works for the world and what works for the individual, right? That's always deeper than just mm-hmm. the surface level of this food looks pretty, right?
Well, sure. But then, yeah, right. It's up to the like individual to sort of decide.
It is. And so what the average individual is sort of seeing, and you can both speak to this, but every day, what is the relationship they're going to have with food on media and on their dinner plate? It's going to be advertising, essentially. We see the most food-related content in advertising, and that has really no interest in sharing sort of how to live well and consume food well. That's trying to get you to buy something. So I think most people are used to seeing food media in one way, and to even share that it's being done in a different way for the first time, people aren't used to that.
Do you think the way that you're doing food media is different from traditional food advertising? Like, how is it different?
I think the influencer space, quote unquote, is a really unique lens that has honestly only emerged in the branding lens in the past probably 5 years or so.
Sure.
Whereas a brand will pay an influencer or pay someone on social media to promote their product. I think it's unique in the sense that the reason that brands pay so much money for people to do this is because it feels like word of mouth advertising.
Mm-hmm.
It is the 2020 version of your friend telling you to try something, because like you both have said, that's what social media is becoming. It's kind of like this window into someone else's life. And mm-hmm. oh, if they're recommending this to me, I mean, of course I'll try it. It means a lot more than just seeing it, you know, as like a Super Bowl commercial. So I think that is, it's challenging. And that's why I think it's so important that if you are someone that is working with brands, that you really try to focus as much as you can on brands that you really support.
Mm-hmm. Right. You think that's largely possible? I mean, to make a successful enterprise of yourself, not necessarily you individually, but of an influencer, is it possible to work with exclusively brands that you feel are doing either a neutral job or a good job of producing quality content and quality products? Or is there sort of this drive to work with, you know, whatever brand will support you?
I think I can't speak to what this was like, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I think today, just because of the proliferation that we've seen of food brands that are actually doing good in the world, it is definitely feasible.
Great.
All of the brands that I've worked with really try to focus on that as mm-hmm. much as possible.
Great.
They try to stick to their values. Again, I'm not sure if this will always be the case. I do feel that soon enough, the bubble will burst and there will not be as many brands pushing for this kind of advertising. I cannot predict when that will be, but yeah.
You know, if it remains a way to get the eyeballs of the public, it'll be here for a little while at least. Although you're right, who can afford to do this if it's not the most useful thing, the biggest companies only. So that's a challenge, although mm-hmm. it's great to hear that it's possible. And I think a lot of people, myself included for a long time, pretty aggressively thought that the only way to make money in media and advertising was to take money from huge, huge companies that really didn't have much care for the environment. But that's definitely been changing. I'm thrilled to know that that is true nowadays.
So let's just go back a little bit to sustainability. So I guess, yeah, I mean, you said you've always been eating kind of vegetarian with thinking about the environmental impact of your food choices. I'm just curious if you think like sustainability is just, what do you think about the word sustainability? Is it a good word to describe where we're headed with sustainable eating or just is it too? I mean, I think there's a lot of issues with it because, I mean, we like the word, but I mean, I think it can be too vague and confusing to people.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think that it is such a broad term and it can mean so many different things to different people. For one person, you know, drinking a glass of almond milk could be sustainable because you're not drinking dairy milk. But for someone else, you mm-hmm. know, that almond milk glass is so resource intensive yeah. to produce. Mm-hmm. You know, one almond is like a gallon of water mm-hmm. just to grow. So I think that spectrum is challenging and it really does tend to push you towards an idea of perfectionism where if I'm not eating in this perfectly sustainable way, then what's the point? Right. Like I mentioned earlier, I think that the way you eat is impacted by so many different things. Really, you know, your culture is a huge, huge piece of that. So I think it's unreasonable to expect people to change their diets for these purely extrinsic forces. I think there needs to be some kind of internal drive to do it if they're going to. That's why I really try to focus on affordability when it comes to my recipes and also just like the time-saving nature of them. Yeah. I think everyone loves to save time when it comes down to it. Yeah. So if I'm able to provide a resource that gives someone those tools, focusing on the benefits of that kind of lifestyle as opposed to, you know, pushing certain labels on people, I think that can be really, really helpful.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's also feasible for most people, for everyone to give up meat. I don't think that's feasible, which is why I also try to avoid more restrictive terms. I think that's just, if we're pushing towards change, that's not something that's going to get us there.
What do you think about the novel alternative meats that we've seen recently?
So to be totally honest, I don't personally enjoy them. And that is solely because I did not grow up eating meat.
Yeah.
I am. So my fiance, Dan, we've tried a few of them together. Actually, when we lived in DC, there was a food truck run by The Economist magazine that would give out like Beyond Meat style burgers for free, which was really cool. And he has kind of grown up eating meat his whole life and he really enjoyed it. So I think it's definitely a cool way to get people to eat in a more sustainability focused way in terms of the less resources being involved. I think that it is a mistake if people automatically assume that those are necessarily healthier for them. True. I don't think they need to be healthier True. For you. I think they just need to be an alternative for you. It's just something to try. I think the fake meat revolution, or whatever you want to call it, has been a really great way to kind of introduce people to these more novel ways of eating.
Yeah, I think we would generally agree with that.
Yeah, we did a whole episode on this, and we should have said, you know, this is not even for us, for any of us here, and not for many of our guests. This is for people who love hamburgers and are eating them five times a week in fast food context. And this is a way to get a person who will continue to love eating hamburgers to do that with potentially 1,000 times less environmental impact, 1,000% rather, sorry. That's not a bad thing. Not a bad thing at all.
It's not a silver bullet, but it's, I don't think it's a bad thing.
So it's interesting to know that in fact, yeah, this is the report we've heard from various vegans and vegetarians we've interviewed before, is that it's really not for us. It's for people who are constantly eating factory farm meat. This is a new approach to that. And the fact that it tastes a whole lot like it is pretty encouraging, and for the right crowd.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah, that's great. Do you think there's a space for other alternative food products? We're talking about, you know, reinventing, in some contexts, milk as well. We're reinventing fish protein. We're going to reinvent dairy into cheese protein as well. So would that be something that, you know, someone who isn't necessarily eating a lot of meat would still be interested in, you think?
I think so. I think just as everyone becomes generally more knowledgeable about the source for their food, that will just continue to kind of push forward. Mm-hmm. I feel like I read, you know, every single week about a new startup with funding for some kind of cell-based meat, or they're saying seafood will be the next great revolution when it comes to that kind of manufacturing, which I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think it'll be really exciting to watch. Again, when it comes to me personally, I really am like, okay with like beans and lentils and rice.
Yeah.
But for other people, I think that's a wonderful entree for them.
Going back to what you said about sustainability. Yeah, I think about this a lot because I think, like, I was thinking about sustainability in branding, in media, because I'm in a program in my PhD where, you know, doing like a graduate certificate, kind of like the plant-based one you did, I guess. And it's focused on industrial ecology, and that's sort of like this large-scale way to quantitatively measure the environmental impacts of products or processes. So, like, there's a lot of people doing industrial ecology studies on specific food products and processes. So you were saying almond milk is a great example, right? Like, according to, you know, this quantitative measurement that we're doing, like, people are trying to use these quantitative measurements, like, I think in a business context to try to prove that their product is more sustainable, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I guess I don't really have a good question, but I just think that that's really interesting and complicated. If we focus on, like, the word sustainability as a way to brand things, it's just so vague. You know, how do we either focus on it or, I mean, I guess it's happening anyway, but maybe what's the best way to brand that kind of word, or like a vague word like that?
It's challenging. I mean, natural is a perfect example of that as well. Every single brand I see in Whole Foods is natural.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that means, I mean, we all know that means nothing. That doesn't, you don't have to do anything to get your food to have a natural label. Even the label of organic is one that I struggle with.
Yeah.
Because organic is, it just does not mean something is sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of benefits to the term organic, but I think that it can be prohibitive for certain people, especially people that really, really rely on labels to tell them whether something is good or bad for them.
Yeah. Would you say that you rely on labels? Probably not when you're picking foods.
So I personally don't, but this is just something that it's come with time and with understanding. I was very fortunate to come from a household that really valued foods and growing our own foods, and I know most people don't have that experience.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that there will be more clarity around it, but also just bringing us back to a focus on not just looking at labels, but how the food makes us feel. I think it's really, really easy to latch on to a label itself, and Emily talks about this a lot. Emily Eats talks about this a lot, where if you're just relying purely on a label to tell you something, that it's not going to give you the full picture.
Right.
Certainly. So what factors are you looking at? I mean, are you looking at specific ingredients? Are you looking at specific companies? Are you looking at specific recipes you're trying to make? What are the factors that go into decisions that you make getting food?
So for me, right now, definitely living in California, it's a benefit because I'm trying to support local agriculture as much as I can.
Great, us
too. That is sometimes that is cost prohibitive, as I'm sure you guys know. It's much more expensive as opposed to going to like a Trader Joe's. So I do it when I can. I do it when my budget allows for it. I think that organic farmers, for the most part, do try to keep the environment in mind, which is why I think supporting them is a good thing. I also know that getting an organic certification is very, very costly. Mm-hmm. Which is why a lot of farmers at, like, my, you know, San Diego farmers markets, they can't afford that certificate. So I try to keep an open mind when it comes to that. At the end of the day, if I'm just talking to someone who's, you know, curious about whether or not they should, purchase only organic foods. I think that there's just not enough research that I've seen. Yeah. Emily, I'm sure that you would know this better. There's not enough research that I've seen that shows that organic produce is necessarily better for you than non-organic. And I would much rather someone eat, if they can afford it and if they have access to it, eat a non-organic version of like a carrot.
Yeah,
Emily, I'm sure you can speak to that piece. I mean,
when it comes to the organic stuff, yeah, unfortunately, it is very, very nuanced, and we've done whole podcasts about this. But health-wise, there's virtually no difference. The only difference comes at the environmental mm-hmm. level, at the supply chain level. The companies that are producing these foods are overall much, much less caring for the environment, for people, and for animals. And the environmental downstream impacts are usually much, much greater.
Usually, but yeah, but you make a good point, Emily, because, right, if they're really local, really small farmers and they can't afford the organic label, then that's an exception to your rule.
Right, it certainly could be. And there could be a situation where that small farmer is doing nothing wrong and is actually doing farming at a more sustainable level. They just didn't get a certification. So I love that situation, and I hope that's what's happening most of the time. There's a lot of large companies trying to sell the opposite. So mm-hmm. it's certainly worth looking into in certain situations.
Definitely. And I would love to hear, or I would love to learn more about, Emily, what you mentioned with that quantitative measurement, because I think that the carbon emissions that go into shipping something across the country right. should definitely be factored into whether or not something is sustainable.
Right.
Yeah, no, that
it's
is.
Just so many parts.
Yeah, no, I think it's a relatively new field. They've termed it industrial ecology. It uses a okay. lot of sort of, yeah, large-scale quantitative impact assessments to determine, yeah, carbon footprints, environmental impacts of industrial products and processes. Yeah, and so, like, where I'm at UC Davis, there's a lot of people doing food and agriculture research and stuff. So there's food and agriculture environmental impact assessments being done a lot. And definitely the transport is a huge part of that type of assessment. Yeah, like how it's really in depth. It's like, what is the fuel, the type of fuel that's being used, the type of electricity generated, all that kind of stuff. It's a majorly like energy. It's a lot about energy impact mm-hmm. And water in terms of like how was the food grown in the farm. Mm-hmm.
From what I've seen looking over her shoulder and looking into this concept myself, it's really not rocket science, but it is hard science to look at what goes into getting really raw ingredient food from a farm to a table. And most people mm-hmm. have just never, ever thought about what kind of fuel the transport truck is using to get to the, you know, second or third middle level processing factory where workers may not be working in excellent conditions, and you know mm-hmm. that factory itself can be located closer to a coal-fired power plant, so its electricity is probably worse than the one at the grocery store that received it. That level of analysis is beyond 99.9% of people, not for ignorance, mm-hmm. but just through abstraction. It's far enough away and complicated enough that there's no hope that they're going to investigate it in that way. So it's just about taking the time to go through these pretty basic steps of looking at how did thing A get from location B to location C.
Yeah, that's a good description. I mean, I'm really interested in it, but then I think, well, are we going to use these metrics as ways to brand things as sustainable? Like, I don't know. How do you do that? I guess that's not my field.
That'll be a longer process, but it's valid for all of us to think about how these labels get applied and what will eventually deserve the sustainability moniker. I mean, that's, I'm sure, something that will eventually be on labels if it's not already.
Yeah. I heard recently, I don't know if you heard this, that Whole Foods started a regenerative agriculture label in 2020, which I think is interesting.
That's neat.
Yeah. I don't know. Just a new kind of label.
Well, you guys are saying that makes me think so much of just the fact that we all really care about this, but when it comes to actually creating systemic change, what is it that's going to be moving the needle for more people to be purchasing these kinds of products? And I wish I could say that it was them caring about carbon emissions, but I don't think that it is. So that's the question. That's kind of what we're here talking about today. Like, what is it that's actually going to move people to make these changes, and like, what is it going to impact their daily lives? You know,
that's a good summary, I think. Mm-hmm.
What do you think in your experience has been the most convincing or impactful? I mean, what's been some people have responded to most positively that you thought was also beneficial to the environment and to their health?
Anything that is financially driven, in my experience. That's why I went into economics and did a lot of behavioral economics work when I was in school, because I think that for most people, it'll come down to a cost analysis of whether or not this is going to save them. And that's why I think outside of the food space, but in the just general like global sustainability space, I think that if you can motivate people with dollars, it does a lot, and it does a lot quickly. I don't know if you guys have more to add on that, but.
No, I think that's pretty much our perspective.
We spoke recently to someone who indicated that the average American is wasting around $100 a month, $1,200 a year in food waste. And that's irrecoverable money that is literally being thrown away, and it is entirely their fault. So anything that a person can do to reduce that burn, to reduce the amount that they are overbuying or overcooking or whatever it is that's spoiling, that is money back in their pocket. And money saved is money earned plus a little bit more.
Right, and then food waste is something that obviously has a major sustainability impact as well. So, yeah, we've been talking to some people. We're pretty interested in that space because I feel like it overlaps sustainability values with, you know, a financial incentive for consumers and companies in a lot of ways.
Yep, and a second tier of that is my experience has been anything that will save people time, like I mentioned earlier. I think that's why we're seeing so many like food delivery.
You know, that's true, yeah, right.
Options these days, I think. And I mean, that's money as well. But people really, really value their time. And they're obviously only have so much time during the day. And if we can find anywhere where we can make things easier, we're going to do it as humans. So.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Yeah, that's a great point. Convenience, for sure.
Yeah.
Would you mind sharing your personal opinion on GMOs? We just think it's an interesting topic, so I don't know if you have a strong opinion there.
Yeah, no, I do. As someone, like I said, I am not an expert by any means. This is just a purely personal viewpoint.
Yeah.
I think that it's unfortunate that labels like GMO tend to detract people from eating in a certain way or tend to restrict their diet. Nothing that I have seen proves that anything that is GMO is necessarily bad for you. It's something that's been conflated a lot in the media, and scare tactics are always, you know, a really flashy way, again, to get people's attention. I honestly have no problem with it at all. I eat seedless watermelon all the time.
Yeah.
I also think it'll be interesting as the population continues to increase. If we can't find ways to solve the systemic food issues, there's going to need to be more research into how we're going to feed as many people on this planet as we can. I hope that it comes in the form of things like revising the food system, like we're talking about.
So,
I mean, I always think there. I think personally, as I have a master's degree in nutrition science, and I'm doing a PhD in like food and agricultural sciences, and it's really interesting to me, sort of this dichotomy between like a lot of people in my world are like, we need GMOs to feed the world, and I don't know. Like, and then we talked to like this food anthropologist the other day on our podcast, and you know, he thinks that just a cultural shift is all we need. And, you know, I mean, maybe we need both. Maybe a cultural shift would be the best case scenario. But, you know, in the meantime, perhaps we need some sort of technologies that help increase yield. I don't know. I'm not really sure.
As usual, there's nothing really wrong with what either of you have said, but it's sort of my role as the devil's advocate or angel's advocate here to remind everyone that it's really about environmental cost. Yeah, there's scientifically, as far as we can tell, really not much harm from consuming GMO foods, but who owns those GMO seeds? Who owns these processes? For the most part, it's absolutely enormous multinational companies that have zero interest in being sustainable. So, at the same time, there's nothing directly incompatible with being sustainable and being GMO'd. There are bananas that we can all eat that were heavily GMO'd that are now sustainably farmed. That exists. And it's the same with rice. There are all these common foods, nutritionally dense, that are more or less good for the planet, and those are things that never got in certain ways controlled by huge companies. So it's about finding, again, the nuance between the advertising and all the sorts of marketing talk that goes into it, the information that you're misleading, to figure out what's actually true. So it's an option for some situations, but we really have to investigate who's advertising what and who owns the technology and where it's being used and its downstream effects on the environment. I know, boring long answer to that little question. But,
no, it's a complicated topic.
It's a complicated topic. And so, right, the average person is going to look at this and say, is it healthy? And the answer is, yeah,
mostly
neutral, fine. But
yeah, I mean, all the GMO products that have been, you know, have been shown to be healthy.
Right, more or less. It's an environmental thing. And those people who are, you know, living on the farms, look at that. And there's a big difference there. Mm-hmm. So you have to do a little bit of digging and just looking at the supply chain for food and looking at industrial ecology. Once you dig in, you find a lot more nuance that people just aren't seeing on the surface.
Yeah, I mean, that's why, yeah, I mean, that's why I don't know. It's like, I don't like these labels because I really don't think, as a scientist, GMOs should be in a group altogether because they could be so different.
Right.
Right. You know, there are GMOs that have been used to, there's been GMOs that are resistant to certain pests, you know, or that help crops grow with less water. I mean, you could argue those are sustainable technologies. Mm-hmm. So, it's kind of interesting. It's like how you use the technology, how you use the GMO.
I think we haven't seen it yet, but I would love to see something that came to market that was a product that was heavily GMO'd, owned by a small company, farmed ethically with good quality, you know, every step of the way in its processing. I think that would blow most people's minds. And I don't think we've really seen something quite like that, or at least advertised that way.
I mean, the Impossible Burger is kind of close.
In a way, yeah. GMO-free. In a way. That's a great point, actually. Mm-hmm. And it's already drawn them a little bit of controversy, but for the most part, I think people have pretty much accepted like that's happening. That is a great example. There you go. Although I think the interesting thing is, I think they are the company that makes it, Impossible Foods, they're pretty eager to distance themselves from those articles that talk about it because they see it as a negative in advertising.
Yeah, but I mean, who can blame them? Because there's so many people that so have such a negative perception. Right. So I think it's about changing the public perception.
At the same time, not sort of just whitewashing it and saying it's fine. But
I don't really know.
Look, we used it well, and it's possible to do that well, but it's not always this way. Yeah, that's tough. That's already a hard conversation to have in a label, right? In one little label.
So do you think you'll keep working in this sort of social media food influencer space?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I think that when it comes down to it, I don't enjoy Instagram. Mm. I
gasp.
That might be a bad thing to say. I really just enjoy creating recipes that are helpful for people. And if Instagram is one way to connect with a certain group of my audience, then that's great. But when it comes to blog, like actual blog traffic, I get very, very little blog traffic from Instagram.
Wow.
Which I'm fine with. It's more just like I'll do it for fun. But when it comes to building a brand that's not my focus, I think it can be dangerous if your brand relies solely on things like social media. It also is really easy to detract from creating quality content. If you're able to provide those, like, you know, juicy inside secrets on your Instagram, it doesn't really matter if you're producing something that's good.
Yeah.
So, I'm not sure. I think I would, just love to continue to grow it as much as I can. But yeah, I mean, what's cool is there are just so many opportunities right now to work in this space, and that's really exciting for me.
Fantastic. Yeah, we certainly agree, and the more people are sharing the good word, the better. It's the best way to get the world changed is to change people's minds.
If anyone's interested, I produce recipes weekly on my website.
Of course.
It's called Garlic Head. So garlic-head.com.
Oh, cool.
I thought of that name just for one. It's kind of like a play on words, like I said, like garlic obsessed. But also it kind of reminds me not to take anything too seriously when it comes to these kinds of issues. At the end of the day, it's really, really easy to take yourself really, really seriously when it comes to this. But if you can just make small changes, I think that's what's really helpful. So, thank you guys so much. This has been so fun.
Thanks so much. We loved having you.
Thank you again. And we'll have links to Emily in the description so you can check her out online.